Welcome to On the Money. You can find out anything and everything to do with finance, business, and the economy. On the Money is recorded live from the studios of Radio 2SER, nationwide on the Community Radio Network. I'm Toby Hemmings, and coming up on the program this week...
But what I think is the more exciting thing is the potential that if this bubble works as the way it should, then we can start looking at Fiji and some of the Pacific Island.
Come fly with me. Let's fly away. But only to New Zealand, now that the Trans-Tasman travel bubble, is scheduled to be opened on April 19th. Also on the program, warehouse workers for Amazon in Alabama are fed up and are pushing for the right to unionize in a landmark response to a company that has ridden roughshod over employees' rights. But will the picket line hold? Stay tuned for all this and more coming up on the Money. But first, the steel city of Whyalla is at risk with the local steelworks operator GFC Alliance in financial trouble. The steelworks' main financier, Greensill Capital, has filed for insolvency protection and Credit Suisse has filed in court to try and wind up the business. I spoke with Emeritus Professor Roy Green of UTS and asked him how this crisis compares with the last time the business was entered into administration.
The difference is that Whyalla is now a well-performing steelworks. It's not in debt. It has a full order book. It's benefited from the worldwide increase in steel demand over the last few years, lots of construction work, especially here in Australia. And it has a transition plan that was put into place by the new owners, GFG Alliance, led by someone who's now well known to us in Australia, Sanjeev Gupta. And that was with a view to developing new renewable sources of energy, much cheaper energy to run the plant and connect it also with its sources of iron ore and coking coal, at least until the point that Sanjeev Gupta's vision of a green steel facility using hydrogen was feasible. But right now, Whyalla and the other parts of the GFG Alliance business in Australia are reasonably well-performing assets. But the problem is that GFG Alliance has lost one of its sources of finance with the collapse of Greensill.
It seems as though Greensill was its predominant source of finance. Do you think that given such reliance on a company that is now insolvent, that this presents a problem for all the people who are working down there at the steelworks?
Well, not yet. The situation is undoubtedly precarious, but it's basically getting new sources of finance that we're talking about for viable businesses. If the businesses were failing, then obviously there would be a problem, and that problem is potentially compounded by Credit Suisse coming in to get Whyalla and some coal assets wound up in Australia to fund debt elsewhere in the world, because we're talking about $6 billion of debt. And so if that were to be a problem, then of course the people at Whyalla would have a right to be very concerned. But right now, the GFG Alliance senior team looking at new sources of finance. They assure the world that those sources of finance will step in. In the scheme of things, $6 billion sounds like a lot of money, but in the world of finance, it's crumbs off the table, and it's by no means impossible within the timescale of these court actions that Credit Suisse is bringing to make those arrangements. Greensill's methodology, I guess, was simply to cover invoices in the supply chain and to have those insured. And so it has created potential sort of domino effect in the supply chain if it all falls over. But if new sources of finance can be brought in time, then production and the supply chain management continues as normal.
What sort of work has Whyalla Steelworks picked up in that turnaround period since 2016?
Well, it's expanded its activities in construction and infrastructure in Australia. That's where most of its product will go. Sometimes the product gets finished elsewhere. It's essentially a blast furnace, so it's producing some finished steel products, some not so finished, which get done elsewhere. But the demand is out there in the domestic market, like BlueScope in Port Kembla, doing quite well out of the current economic environment.
Part of Sanjeev Gupta's plan for Whyalla was to pour in $1 billion to transforming the plant, expanding production and widening their product offering. Have they turned the process of making steel out of renewable energy into a possibility? How far down the track are they, would you say?
It's still early days, I think, for that new technology. There are experiments going on around the world. One of GFG Alliance's assets is already experimenting with green steel. That's in Romania. There's a Swedish company that's doing similar in Sweden. So there are some experiments going on. The key issue is cost, of course. Technology is readily available. The question is, can it be cost competitive with the use of coking coal? And what GFG Alliance is doing is pulling into place all of the assets and sources of energy it will need to make that transformation successful before they actually invest in the change in technology within the plant itself. So there's a lot going on in the investment in renewables, in battery storage, etc., in South Australia, not just within GFG Alliance, but in conjunction with some other companies. And the idea is that in those investments will fall into place with the transformation of the technology within the Whyalla plant itself at a future time. What that future time is it 1 year, 2 years, 5 years? I do not know, but it will be when that particular technology becomes cost competitive. And when it does, it's a bit like grid parity in solar energy. Costs will then start to go down quite dramatically, and potentially we then have an export market for steel as well.
It sounds like there's the potential for this type of steelworks to be at the cutting edge, contingent on hitting that point of cost competitiveness. It has been discussed today. I believe it was Simon Birmingham, the finance minister, stated that the federal government is looking at all options, and seemingly there is the potential for the federal government to step in and offer a lifeline to the Whyalla Steelworks. What do you make of that?
The thing is, it depends on this Credit Suisse action in the courts to have Whyalla wound up. This is really reflecting Credit Suisse's problem rather than GFG Alliance's. I think some of the headlines have been somewhat sensational around the so-called fall of Gupta, as it was portrayed on the front page of the Financial Review. It's really the fall of Credit Suisse, I think. And the question is, will Credit Suisse take down everyone with them? And so the idea of a lifeline is to ensure that that's not the case.
It does seem like it's a pretty precarious situation for all parties involved at the moment.
Yes, I think you'd have to say it was precarious, but by no means fatal. I don't think anyone should be despondent about the situation in Whyalla at this stage. We're certainly not ready for that. We can look on the bright side, but be prepared for whatever happens in the short term that may upset calculations. Whether the Credit Suisse action succeeds or not remains to be seen, and it may be drawn out over a number of weeks. Even though the action starts, I think, in early May, it's not going to happen overnight. And so there's plenty of time for GFG Alliance to have its financial house in order.
That was Roy Green, Emeritus Professor and former Dean at the UTS Business School, speaking with me. I'm Toby Hemmings, and you're listening to On The Money around Australia on the Community Radio Network. No,
doesn't make sense to me. If your dollars don't make sense, listen to On The Money.
On April 19, the Trans-Tasman quarantine-free travel bubble will finally open between Australia and New Zealand. For Australians and Kiwis alike, there is a hunger to get back in the air and return to the normalcy of tourism. Airline operators are also thrilled to be taking to the skies, as Talia Kreft found out when she spoke to Neil Hansford, the chairman of Strategic Aviation Solutions.
I think a big aspect will be family reunion between New Zealanders living in Australia, wanting to return and see their family. But from the other side, I think a lot of us Australians, they've done as much domestic tourism. They want to go international and they want to go and see what New Zealand has to offer. And hence the comment that New Zealand will be far better financially out of the bubble than what Australia will be, simply because there's 26 million of us and so much less of the Kiwis, so they've got more people who will want to travel.
How affordable will it be for Australians to holiday in New Zealand?
If you've got to take relative distance and you're flying Perth-type distances, so you should expect to enjoy Perth-type fares. And I think for airlines like Qantas and Air New Zealand, with all of the costs that they're bearing from COVID, they will need to fill the aircraft to 85 to 90% to be able to run economically. Now, to do that, they will be very, very competitive on fares. And even Qantas operating 122 flights a week is a very significant commitment.
Are there risks involved for Australians travelling to New Zealand?
The only uncertainty really is going to come from the Premier of Queensland and the Premier of Victoria, and to a degree the Premier of Western Australia, who use COVID events as political advantages. So the danger is a family goes over to New Zealand, has a lovely holiday, something happens in Queensland and Premier Palaszczuk decides, no, we're going to have a lockdown. So those people on their return to Australia have to go into 14 days of quarantine, which they don't have the holidays for, and certainly probably don't have up to $10,000 to pay for the quarantine. So that's a very big risk, not a risk in New South Wales, because the Premier here has been very mature about border closures and they don't have the same threat over them. And the other danger is if Australia starts highlighting hotspots, the New Zealanders will then have to stop those hotspots and start having Australians who were intending to have a holiday in New Zealand having to go into quarantine, and that will just kill the whole thing off. You'll have a lot of people's holidays disrupted financially and everything else, and the whole thing will just grind to a halt.
Do you expect that demand for flights could outweigh the supply of flights for trips to New Zealand?
The answer to that is no. In my long history in the airline business, is that the thing that airlines can do is increase, even if they only operate the same number of flights, they can increase the size of the aircraft. So where the aircraft that might have been scheduled to have a 737-800 flying it, they will substitute an A330 to carry more passengers. So they will keep on opening the gates to have more, because Qantas at the moment is not flying internationally save repatriation flights. So they have all of their international fleet of 787s and A330s available to them to throw into the market. They can do a lot of upgauging to meet the market and satisfy Australians. And there's enough accommodation in New Zealand because they don't have their Chinese market or their Japanese market at the moment. So there's a lot more room for Australians.
Do you expect Australia will be a popular choice for Kiwis as a holiday destination?
It already is, and it already has been for a very long time. Kiwis are our greatest tourists, and everybody talks about China. China is well down on the number of people that choose to have holidays in Australia, but there's just such a large New Zealand population on the Gold Coast, Sydney, Melbourne. Now, there's a lot of potential, and Qantas and Air New Zealand will provide the capacity. As long as people don't play politics, it will work, and the New Zealanders love the Gold Coast, so they'll pour into the Gold Coast. But if three people get sick again and Palaszczuk closes it, that'll be killed off and everybody will be uncertain.
Which regions in Australia do you think will be the biggest beneficiaries of the travel bubble?
Far North Queensland, because of the mild climate, the Far North Queensland, the Whitsundays and the Gold Coast will be the major beneficiaries. Sydney will always be, because it's a big city, it's a very vibrant city. We're opening up our nightlife and young Kiwis will will always enjoy the high life of Sydney, then possibly Melbourne. I don't expect too much increase in Western Australia, and I don't expect that the wine country will attract a great number of young, but it will attract mature tourists.
Do you expect that New Zealanders holidaying here could drive up the price of domestic travel for Australians?
I don't expect it to happen. Certainly, while the Australian 50% sails on, that's the winter. We're now going into the quiet time, the poor time, and when it comes to Christmas, we'll be like every other Christmas where New Zealanders come and go. What we haven't got this plague of Chinese tourists, so all of that accommodation will all be available at reasonable prices, because whereas the Chinese groups were enjoying the hot prices, the hotels will have to provide those to Australians and New Zealanders. And the good thing is that with a New Zealander or an Australian going over there, we actually don't prepay for our accommodation. So an Australian or a New Zealander will pay for the airfare and their accommodation and possibly their breakfast, but they then buy everything else in the local market, unlike the Chinese full-board type tourists who have very little liquid spending because it's all part of their group and they paid for it in China before they left.
Which businesses do you expect will benefit from the opening of the Trans-Tasman bubble?
Look, obviously the airlines, then you get the airline handling agents, you get the catering, you'll have to have far greater numbers of customs. The airports will have to go back to their old manning levels, and that's both sides of the ditch. And then I think the people that will really benefit is the hotel market, certainly in the 3 to 4 star market, both sides of the Tasman. And if the 5 star hotels meet the market, they'll also enjoy it. So by having our brothers as part of the bubble, that's very easy to manage. We all speak the same language. We talk about how competitive we are, but in the end, we could just as easily all be one nation.
Is the announcement of the Trans-Tasman bubble good timing with the end of JobKeeper for many travel agencies and other tourism businesses? Is this a welcome relief for them?
It's some relief, but I'm afraid young people are tech savvy and they will tend to use the internet to buy their flights, and they'll buy it on the web. Some of the older folk will certainly use agents, so there will be a lift in the agents. But what I think is the more exciting thing is the potential that if this bubble works as the way it should, then we can start looking at Fiji and some of the Pacific Islands, because I'm afraid Bali and Thailand, because of the raging COVID situation, will be a long time before they're available to Australians. So we'll see the Pacific develop well, New Zealand will develop well, then we may well start getting into, say, Singapore, which has got a good environment. But more importantly, Vietnam and Cambodia are some of the best performers on COVID in the world, and they rank higher than Australia in their management of COVID. We've got to get this bubble right, and then the government has the ability then to start opening bubbles with other holiday destinations. So by Christmas, we could well see Australians having a far greater choice of where they go, but their traditional markets like Indonesia and Thailand will be some way off because they fundamentally are not on top of COVID.
Neil Hansford, Chairman of Strategic Aviation Solutions, ending that report from Talia Kraft.
On the Money. Ride the gravy train with us.
Amazon warehouse workers in Bessemer, Alabama, have voted in a historic poll to determine whether they'll be represented by a union. With a turnout rate of 55%, this represents a potential turning point after 60 years of continued union decline in the United States. Amazon has been strongly against previous attempts to unionize, with well-publicized poor employment conditions. Gabriela Montero has the story.
Last month, in March, nearly 6,000 workers at an Amazon plant in Bessemer, Alabama, finalized a vote to decide whether or not to unionize. If this union vote were to succeed, it would mark the first Amazon warehouse to be unionized in the United States. Dr. Louise Floyd, Associate Professor at James Cook University, notes the reasons why the US has such a different relationship with unions compared to other countries like Australia.
At the general level, unionism has been declining quite a bit in America, you know, over the last several decades. Part of that is there's a very individualistic culture in the United States. So whereas in places like Australia and to an extent Europe, people are far more likely to band together for a purpose, and culturally, you know, that's, you know, something which is more a natural fit with them. In the United States, it's a very individualistic society.
The reasons for this union vote are also wide and varied, primarily stemming from the self-realisation of the value that these workers create and demands for better working conditions.
Are we necessarily getting the deal that we want? And particularly in things like, you know, the number of breaks they get, et cetera, et cetera. Are we really convinced that we're getting the workplace that we want, particularly now that the rest of society is saying, well, they're essential workers. Without their hard work, our orders wouldn't be fulfilled and whole offices couldn't work from home. So I think that was a part of it.
Dr. Drew Cottle, adjunct professor at Western Sydney University, highlights some of these poor working conditions, noting that a union is important in order for workers to improve their current situation.
The reason they sought to unionise was because of the speed up of the line and because of the other appalling conditions. You know, limited toilet breaks, the need to for drivers, for example, to urinate in bottles to meet destination schedules, etc. I think only through establishing a union can the workers then organise and bargain for the possibility of better working conditions and higher pay.
Additionally, concerns about break times and surveillance while working are issues that have been brought up as reasons for a change.
The pressure points that, you know, people are concerned about are things like, you know, their break time, whether there's maybe too much surveillance. Those sorts of issues seem to be the things, as I read the American press, that they seem to be very significant factors. Are they getting sufficient rest? Are they getting sufficient breaks if they're working so hard and being so productive? And also, when you look at the automation and the surveillance, you know, is that something with which workers would feel comfortable?
Retaliation from Amazon at this attempt to unionise has been wide and varied.
The response of Amazon is somewhat predictable. They insisted, because of the COVID virus bonuses they were apparently giving to the workers, this would suffice. The other thing that Amazon have done is that they've created pre-work meetings where Amazon officials have stated that that there's no need to bring in unions or to unionise the workforce. Their concerns for the workers will be uppermost. They've sent a video to the workers.
Compared to Australia, the United States has less of a union presence and culture. Whereas unionisation is more commonplace in Australia, it is sparse in the United States, and actually establishing unions is harder.
So whereas an Australian, it's not really that out of the ordinary that people are unionised. You know, I'm an academic at a university and I'm a member of a union. So it's not that extraordinary a thing. Whereas in the United States, I think they've got to work a fair bit harder to get to be accepted in workplaces. And that's really an example of this. And so they've really got to have a ballot which goes to their National Labor Relations Board, which is their regulator, to get that presence and to get that standing. So it's not that unionisation's impossible in America. They certainly have some really high-profile support.
On this note of retaliation, it is unclear what will come of the vote results itself, with both parties able to contest the results to a point.
Amazon have done everything to prevent even having a postal ballot being established. And strangely enough, Amazon, it still is unknown yet whether Amazon will accept, if you want, the result of the ballot.
Ultimately, this vote represents a potential shift in union culture in the United States, and the flow-on effects of this could be immense, not just for Amazon, but also other sectors of the economy.
This might lead to, if you want, a breakthrough, if it's successful, to many other unions being established, not just in retail and warehousing, but across the American economy. I think this is a very, very important struggle. But, of course, it's yet to be won.
Drew Cottle, Senior Lecturer in Politics and History at Western Sydney University, speaking with Gabriella Montero. I'm Toby Hemmings, and you're listening to On The Money around Australia and on the Community Radio Network. And that's all we have on The Money this week. Tune in again next week to find out everything you need to know about finance, business and the economy. Thanks to our producers Rod Chambers, Talia Kreft and Gabriella Montero this week. On The Money is produced in the studios of Radio 2SER for the Community Radio Network and with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find all our shows and stories at 2ser.com/onthemoney. Subscribe to our podcasts, find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Look for @onthemoney2SER. I'm Toby Hemmings. We'll be back again next week to give you the inside running on all things financial. Do stay well, and thanks for your company.